Hello, my name is Peter Webster. What you're about to hear is a paper given at the winter meeting of the Ecclesiastical History Society in January 2023, which was on the theme of the Church and Hypocrisy. I plan to submit the paper to be considered for publication in Studies in Church History, Volume 60, which, if it was accepted, would appear in 2024. And my title is Vocation, Integrity and Hypocrisy in a Secularising Society, Iris Murdoch and the Clergy of the Church of England. Iris Murdoch published 26 novels over 4 decades, the first in 1954, the last in 1995, thus offering a useful case study in the evolving treatment of particular themes in fiction. As well as this, Murdoch was rare among novelists in being a professional philosopher as well, with interests in matters of metaphysics and ethics that impinged directly on the concerns of the churches. As such, it is possible to read the fiction both on its own terms and in relation to the philosophy, both of which were in dialogue with the theology of her time. Murdoch's own religious upbringing gave her work an undertow of religious concern, often very faint, but persistent nonetheless. In the novels, the institution of the church itself is seldom shown to be anything but ridiculous or irrelevant. But many of Murdoch's characters, who have ostensibly taken leave of all that stuff, spend a good deal of their time discussing what is left behind. As well as this, her novels are peopled by characters mainly from the moneyed, landed and professional parts of English society, from which the Anglican clergy were also largely drawn, and with whom they maintained a social connection that was not so common with the clergy of the other churches. It was among these formers of opinion that much of the debate about the apparent secularisation of English society went on. As Murdoch's characters think and talk about the loss of faith and the difficulty of filling the hole where their God once was, the historian may overhear the reflections of one particularly sensitive artist on the religious temper of her times. Murdoch should be read as one of a generation of artists who had themselves lost faith, but had been shaped in a class and culture that still took religious language and symbolism seriously. Confirmed as an Anglican in 1934 while at Badminton School, by the early 1950s she described herself as more of a fellow traveller than a party member. By the time her writing career was underway, she had firmly rejected the notion of a personal God, and with it, the Christological and soteriological apparatus of Christian theology. However, while Murdoch's philosophical writing is atheistic in character, insofar as it rejects the notion of God as active, purposeful, and possessing some kind of personality, she held nonetheless to the reality of something beyond the physical world, which she understood in Platonic terms as the good. The particular interest of Murdoch for the religious historian, however, lies not only in what she rejected, but in what she tried to retain. Her childhood and education had given her her deep acquaintance with the religious symbolism and public worship. In the 1970s and 1980s she spoke more than once of having regained a sympathy for religious belief which had been crowded out during her earlier engagement with Karl Marx. She read widely in theology and attended Anglican services, rather sporadically, while not participating in the Eucharist. Despite the unresponsiveness of Plato's good to those who might contemplate it, Murdoch remained open to the notion of mystical experience and to the usefulness of something like prayer. And Murdoch more than once alluded to a kind of captivity to Christianity which was not quite something to be resisted, although she could not believe in the supernatural aspects of Christianity. Of course, I can't get away from Christ, who travels with me. Crucially, Murdoch remained convinced that after the removal of God, something had to be put in his place, since to leave a vacuum would prove intolerable. Without ever feeling the need to return to a Christian doctrinal position, she had come by 1988 to feel a need to fill the space with, quote, some more positive kind of reflection, even neo-theology, which would explain very fundamental things about the human soul and the human being. Despite the contingency of human life, an accident in a senseless universe, there remained, quotes, a particular orientation which is unique and special and belongs to us and is part of us. But Murdoch was not an advocate of some new movement that might supersede the church. There was a certain paradox in Murdoch's views when taken as a whole. Her background and disposition led her to think that the present institution of the church could, indeed must, survive the kind of loss of faith that she described in the novels. And this led her to advocate positions which, while apparently quixotic, have a certain kind of coherence. In 1979, she publicly opposed the looming displacement, as it was thought, of the Book of Common Prayer by the Alternative Service Book. We live continually in and through words, she argued. And so to lose the words of the prayer book and the authorised version of the Bible would be a loss, she thought, comparable to Shakespeare. Quotes, it is also, whether or not one believes in God, a spiritual loss. It was, she thought, unlikely that either believers or unbelievers would be able to live by the new words as they had by the old. Another such suggestion was that a kind of religious education might be preserved within families, where parents who did not themselves believe in God might instruct children as if they did, for the practical benefits available. It was necessary that certain aspects of the national faith should persist then, even if its central beliefs could no longer be conscientiously held. Scholars have noted the considerable sophistication, not to say effort, involved in behaving as if there were a transcendent reality, whilst believing there to be no such thing. Such a balancing act could perhaps only be attempted by one of Murdoch's generation and background. It's in this context, then, of knowledge, sympathy, and emotional investment, but without assent, that we should read Murdoch's fictional engagement with the churches. What follows is an examination of some of the Anglican clergy in her fiction, in terms of their integrity or otherwise, to both their vocation and their conscience. In the longer version which I hope to submit to Studies in Church History, I also examine characters who, while themselves untroubled by doubt and acting well within the norms of their profession, nonetheless fail to live up to the exacting ethical standard that Murdoch sets. But in this paper I focus just on those clergy who can no longer assent to the doctrine of their own church, and the subtleties and evasions into which they are forced as a result. I won't examine in detail the theology that these characters articulate, which has been well explored by others. My concern here is with the clergy as social actors, and with the interplay of belief, status and action. It's not difficult to produce examples of clergy in novels of other periods who were held up against the standard of their profession and found wanting. But the theological atmosphere of post-war England was quite distinct in its focus on the secular and on the need for the churches to efface themselves, indeed if not to dissolve their institutional selves completely. Modern man, recently come of age, it was thought, had no time for, indeed could make nothing at all, of the stuff of traditional doctrine. Only a new practical religion of love and service, carried out not within the walls of the church, but in the street or on the factory floor, could now reach those for whom, it seemed clear, the church had lost. This vogue for religionless Christianity was short-lived, but Murdoch's own library included a copy of John A.T. Robinson's The New Reformation, and it seems likely that she also read his earlier Honest to God of 1963, the classic text of what Mark Chapman has called English Bonhoefferism. Murdoch's direct engagement with Dietrich Bonhoeffer was very slight, but revealing nonetheless. Quotes, when Bonhoeffer says that God wants us to live as if there were no God, I suspect he is misusing words. There is, after all, no God in the traditional sense, she thinks, and the traditional sense is perhaps the only sense. The churches then were only tinkering, if they imagined that it was possible to recast themselves in a convincing way while still holding to the real existence of God. The task of the churches, then, was to face the reality of the death of God and to work out what might remain. Four of her clerical characters, from the Time of the Angels of 1966 through to the Book and the Brotherhood of 1987, dramatised this loss of faith and the dilemma that it presented to a clergyman in his office. The Time of the Angels, 1966, features the Fisher brothers, Marcus and his elder brother Carol, the rector of St Eustace Watergate in East London. Marcus has become concerned about his brother, living as a recluse in the rectory and refusing all callers. Marcus is writing a book called Morality in a World Without God, which will, he hopes, rescue the idea of an absolute in morals without resort to theological metaphor. Marcus's friend Nora has her doubts, though. For her, Marcus is just a Christian fellow traveller. Quote, it's better not to tinker with a dying mythology. For Carol, there is no God, but the crisis is deeper and grimmer even than this. All philosophy and theology, theistic or otherwise, is merely a distraction from the senselessness of the universe. Goodness is impossible, he believes. Marcus's project is futile. Quote, there is only power and the marvel of power. There is only chance and the terror of chance. Meanwhile, he intends to stay just where he is, since if there is no God, there is all the more need for a priest. If there is no one there, no one is going to mind. Marcus objects. You're going to carry on with that farce, with all those things inside you? Yes, Carol will carry on, but quoting the Dies Irae, nil in ultum remanebit, nothing would remain unpunished. Quote, although there is no judge, I shall be punished quite automatically out of the great power of the universe. Meanwhile, I endure in the place in which I am. Carol, in whose sepulchral darkness, in the sepulchral darkness of the rectory, exercises a baleful power over those around him, could have found few documented real-life counterparts. But there were nonetheless clergy who lost their faith. From time to time, there were scandalous examples of those who fell short of the moral standards expected of them. There were well-publicised cases of clergy, particularly Roman Catholics, who resigned either for a loss of faith or because they could no longer accept the authority of the church. The mid-60s also saw a very particular discussion, of which Murdoch was definitely aware, about the 39 Articles, the central doctrinal statement of the Church of England, unrevised since 1571, to which clergy were required to assent in a very public and unambiguous way. This was causing difficulty to an increasing number of new ordinands. So the position of the clergy was in question in a new way. In the Time of the Angels, Murdoch explores the reactions of others to Carroll's understanding of his own position. Concerned about his state of mind, Nora and Marcus consult with his bishop. Murdoch doesn't name the bishop, but the parallel is very clearly with John Robinson. Surely, Nora thinks, something must be done about a rector who has lost his faith, and perhaps indeed his mind. He is both mad and wicked. I should certainly call Carol an eccentric, the bishop replies, and the Church of England has been noted for those. It wouldn't do, he thinks, to cause too much of a fuss, which might be difficult to manage. But surely this won't do, Nora thinks. Is it no longer important what a clergyman believes? What about Christ? Frowning slightly at being put on the spot, the bishop replies, much of the symbolism of theology is, in this scientific age, simply a barrier to belief. Our symbolism must change. And as for Carol, the key wasn't his beliefs. Passion, Kierkegaard said, didn't he? Passion. That's the necessary truth. Nora thinks the bishop is playing with fire. It would be better simply to state plainly that God didn't exist. Marcus is disturbed. Despite not believing himself, it was important that someone else did. Quote, that all that business should go on in the old way. Anticipating a later insight of Grace Davy, Marcus's religion had been enacted vicariously on his behalf, but now, quote, behind the scenes, it was all being unobtrusively dismantled. Murdoch picked the theme up again nearly two decades later in Bernard Jacobi, in The Philosopher's Pupil of 1983. Since the time of the angels, Murdoch had read a good deal in the most radical modern theology, including the notorious collection of essays edited by John Hick, The Myth of God Incarnate, 1977, a radical statement of Christology without incarnation. Reading them, she wrote in a letter with some mock surprise, "I have discovered that I am a Christian," in that her understanding of Christ was in fact close to that of Hick and his colleagues. Also in her library were works by Don Cupid, perhaps the most clearly non-realist thinker of his generation. By this time, though, the confidence of Robinsonian radicals that the church could be saved by a kind of secular unmaking of itself had evaporated. Robinson had returned to academic life. One of his most prominent clergy in Southwark had left priestly ministry. Don Cupid, writing in what he regarded as a kind of internal exile as Dean of Emmanuel College, Cambridge, asked what option remained for those who could not subscribe to theological realism. Should Christian radicals like him leave the institutional church entirely to join a, quote, entirely unorganised, invisible church of heretics, artists, writers, humanitarians, lovers of spiritual freedom and of the poor? Murdoch's characters had, he thought, modelled a kind of modern contemplative, whose austerity it was to go out into the world and into solitary, anonymous reflection and service as a symbolic action, a way of bearing unofficial witness to the extremity of the times. Father Jacobi, in The Philosopher's Pupil, had once prayed freely, but now has ceased to believe in any personal God, even though the idea of Christ persists somehow. His prayer, although it contains forms of words that suggest a residual feeling of petition, is largely a free flow of thoughts, a kind of meditative practice that seems to be little more than a kind of disciplined breathing. In the debate between Jacobi and Razanov, the philosopher of the novel's title, it becomes difficult to separate the two voices, as they probe the emptiness of a world without a god, so alike are their positions, and so far from anything resembling orthodoxy. Yet, Jacobi does retain some sense of his own priestly distinctiveness. Part of it is pastoral, but Jacobi also retains some idea of the sacraments, even though they're no symbol of wider spiritual reality, but something more magical, shamanic, which he finds endlessly and thrillingly arcane. "I enact rites," he says, "and wait for people to summon me." This, it seems, is enough for him. But Murdoch shows us the gap between Jacobi's public and private faces. Razanov asks him the question, "Is it not time that Jacobi left the priesthood? Would it not be more honest? With your beliefs, you must feel you're in a false position, living a lie. You must have taken vows. Aren't you breaking them?" "How," Razanov asks, "can he go on like this?" Jacobi, suddenly discomfited, answers, "I just can, that's all." But he's put on the spot later by his flock, to whom he lies directly, and the final crisis of the novel sees him abruptly resign and leave England for an abandoned chapel on the Greek coast, where he can work out his vocation of finding true religion in the repudiation of even the idea of God. Angus McAllister, in The Book and the Brotherhood of 1987, also once believed the language of his childhood faith, which flows freely from him still. Quote, "The high spiritual rhetoric of the Bible and of Cranmer's prayer book was more familiar to him than nursery rhymes." But he too, secretly, has ceased to believe either in God or a divine Christ. Some kind of mystical Christ remains, however, as does the magical power that his ordination conferred on him to, quote, "save souls and raise the fallen." He is most strongly reminded of the ambiguity of his position by the rites of the church that he must still celebrate. He is separated somehow, he feels, from the glowing, radiant object that is the crib at Christmas. Quote, "Because he was a liar, because a line of falsity ran all the way through him and tainted what he did." At Easter too, he's troubled by the, quote, "terrible particularity, the empirical detail of his religion." he asks himself. How could he continue to affirm things that he didn't believe? I have to, he answers. Why? In order to carry on with the life which I have chosen and which I love. Though he felt himself somehow to be, quote, a vehicle of power and a grace that which was given, not his own, there was all the while still a terrible truth never clarified. And so, during the Eucharist, he enacts something, points towards something between his flock and God, but not him, and did so in agony with tears which did him no credit, rather the contrary. While Father Jacobi is propelled out of his position by doubt, Father McAllister, like Carol Fisher, endures because he must. For him, unlike Murdoch's other priests, his dilemma is not resolved for him by events. As the reader sees him for the last time, on he goes. Despite the loss of God, for Murdoch, the church must endure because it's necessary. To conclude, Iris Murdoch's treatment of her Anglican clergy can be read, then, as an extended meditation over 40 years on the church in which she was raised. In the longer paper, I argue that her clergy retain a social connection with English professional and landed society, but that it becomes increasingly threadbare as her novels enter the 1980s. The apparent presumption of the clergy in trying to intervene in pastoral situations, which is politely tolerated in the early novels, becomes more openly and robustly rejected. And the character of that pastoral care is for Murdoch, vitiated by the intrusion of the fat, relentless ego that for Murdoch threatens all human relationships, and by a desire for power or control against which Murdoch always sets her idea of self-emptying attention. In the same character, Murdoch dramatises the loss of Christian faith, which presented the working clergy with acute agonies of conscience and daily disjuncture between outward speech and inner conviction. In the case of Carol Fisher, the dilemma is resolved only by suicide. For Bernard Jacobi, events jolt him out of place and into a kind of exile. For McAllister, it continues in struggle and with tears. The ministrations of the church must continue as a witness to something absolute, even if he, McAllister himself, cannot be sure what it is. The church remains necessary, even if God himself is not. In this quixotic proposition, then, Murdoch exemplifies a tension in her generation which had not arisen earlier, and which, in more recent thinkers, is much less common and inflected rather differently.